The opinions and views expressed on this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show or other programs on KUCI, please log on to KUCI.org for the latest program schedule.
Good morning and welcome to this January 22nd, 2014 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. We are always available via podcast. I'll give you more information later in the hour on how to access that. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone, and as always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each week we're here with authors to talk about craft, content, writing. I'm joined this morning by Jane Isay, author of the book Secrets and Lies. And coming up in the second half hour, Laurie Haltz Anderson will be here to discuss her latest young adult novel, The Impossible Knife of Memory. Jane Isay is the author of two previous books, Walking on Eggshells, about parents and their adult children, and Mom Still Likes You Best, about adult siblings. As an editor for more than 40 years, she discovered Mary Pfeiffer's reviving Ophelia, commissioned Patricia O'Connor's best-selling Woe Is I and Rachel Simmons' Odd Girl Out, and edited such nonfiction classics as Praying for Sheetrock and Friday Night Lights. Her latest book is Secrets and Lies, Surviving the Truths That Change Our Lives. It's published by Doubleday, I think.
Yes,
indeed.
Yes.
And it's my pleasure to welcome her. Joining us all the way from New York this morning, Jane, hi.
Hi, it's nice to be talking to somebody in southern, sunny California.
We're warmer here, probably.
You're warmer.
Than you
I
are.
Can feel it.
I can. You'd be right about that. So I know this book is very close to the bone for you and wrought out of a lot of personal experience. So I'm going to let you talk about its scope and your decision to write it.
Well, I was a book editor for 40 years, and I published a lot of psychology. I realized as I was being an editor that the books that were most powerful were books that came from a place of deep concern and possibly pain in the heart and mind of the author. And so my first book, Walking on Eggshells, I wrote when my grown sons were not returning my phone calls. And I wanted to figure out whatever happened to the children we raised to be independent, and then they went and became independent and we weren't the center of their lives. And the same was true of Mom Still Likes You Best. I wanted to understand the resolved and unresolved relationships between siblings in adulthood. Mm-hmm. When I came to Secrets and Lies, it was a particularly central subject in my life because not only had I been a secret finder, learning a terrifying and life-changing secret from my husband of 15 years, but then I became a secret keeper for another 10 years. And so I've done both, and I thought it would be my preparation for writing this book was rich and deep. The story is that after we were married 15 years and had two sons, 9 and 13, my husband confessed to me that he was homosexual. And when that happened, it was as if somebody had hit the windshield of a car with a bat. All the pieces of my future, all the expectations of my life shattered. Now, they didn't make me bleed because they didn't hit me, but my life was changed in an instant. Mm-hmm. And then we decided, for reasons that I still think were good, anyway, there were our reasons, to keep his sexuality a secret and to continue life as the outside world knew it, even if we didn't. Mm-hmm. And I lied to my sons for almost 10 years. And I know how hard it is to be a secret keeper. And I think it's really important for people to have sympathy and understanding, not only of the person whose life is changed by a thunderbolt, but also some kind of understanding of why people keep secrets and what it does to them.
Right, right. I want to talk a little bit about taking the private public, and going through the process of writing about this has to be slightly different, maybe more cathartic, you can talk about this, than the process of living through it and what was learned through the writing of it that may not have been realized through the living of it.
That's a wonderful question. In fact, all of us are writing to save our own lives.
Mm-hmm.
And when you set about to tell a story that makes you cry as you're writing, you need to be able to find that place in your being where the writing and the words come out as if from a well, as if from a spring.
Mm.
I have found for myself, and certainly for the authors I've worked with, there's a difference between typing and writing. and when you are very deep in your being, that's when it becomes writing. I can tell when something's really good, but may only be a page or two. It usually is only a page or two, because when I do the spell check, there are no errors.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, when I'm typing and I'm struggling, I make mistakes, there are typos and so on, but when it comes clean, it's good. To write about yourself with honesty is extremely hard. It's no fun. And you have to strip your soul. On the other hand, as you said, by the time I was writing the 100 drafts that got me to the final draft for the book, I came to understand many things about myself, about my life, but by that time I had done all the research for my book. I'd interviewed dozens and dozens of people about their secrets and about their revelations. And so my understanding was deepened by my sympathy and by my empathy and by the kindness of the people who had shared their lives with me.
Right. Yeah, I do want to talk about the revision process later, because I would imagine that what comes out initially from the pain and suffering and whatever mm-hmm. you went through has to be massaged and made into
sure.
something more, you know, accessible, coherent, maybe universally true. So
sure.
I want to get to that as well. But I want to stick with this point about taking the private public, because this book is based on the things that you didn't talk about for a decade.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how, with that being buried down so for so long, so deeply, what that experience was like to now be talking about it so publicly.
It's awful.
Yeah. I can imagine.
I don't like it, but I was convinced that, I became convinced that my great credential for writing this book was my own experience, and that if I was going to talk about secrets and lies and truth and revelations, I had an obligation to be honest with the people who were going to read my book. Of course, I showed the final draft to both of my sons before doing anything else, because their lives were very much affected by this. And they were fine with it, kind of.
Fine enough with it. Yeah.
But it's hard. And I don't enjoy talking about it, and I don't enjoy the revelation, but I'm trying to be of help to people who have lived these experiences. And I can't hide myself if I'm going to be of help.
Yeah, right. Let's talk about the people that you interviewed in the research process of this, finding them, getting them to open up about their secrets, which also, you know, were buried for long periods of time. And being so open with you, I imagine that you must have shown them a lot of empathy and compassion to get them to be so open with you.
Well, I'm a good listener.
Yeah.
My son is the founder of StoryCorps, the oral history project,
mm-hmm.
And we believe that listening is an act of love. So, yes. I was lucky. I started out with my friends and their friends, and I widened the circles. There was a point at which I almost gave up because I couldn't get enough people to talk to. But then I wrote a piece about staying married for the children, which was published in the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, was self-revelation. And a lot of people emailed me and said, I have a story. And so I got a second raft of people that way. And you can't help but have empathy for people who are sitting either on the phone with you or in your room telling you of their pain. And it really, really, really enlarged my sense of the human condition by being honored by the people who told me their stories. And some of them were angry, and some of them were hurt, and some of them were unforgiving, and some of them were happy to have found out a truth that they didn't understand something about their lives until the truth came out, and then their skin fit them for the first time. Mm. And everybody who is in my book is a hero one way or another to me. And I also came to realize as I was writing the book that there is no place in this book, at least in my book, for judgment, for anger on my part, and for the use of psychological terms like normal or sick. Mm. We're all members of the human race, with all, and we all share in the human condition.
Yeah, yeah, well said. But did you find that the people who were the secret finders were more forthcoming than the secret keepers?
Yeah, it was easier to find secret finders.
Yeah.
But I did find a handful of secret keepers, and they really opened their hearts to me.
Hmm.
And it was wonderful. Also, because I had been a secret keeper, I had empathy with them.
It's such a burden, and it's a burden to live that way, and it must be very cathartic to unburden oneself, right?
Well, I think people don't have enough empathy for those of us who have held something shameful from other people.
Right.
It really, really, really is not fun, as the people I interviewed told me and as I had experienced.
Right, right. My guest this morning is Jane Isay. The book is Secrets and Lies. Let's talk a little bit about writing process as therapy for you versus writing process as therapy for others versus just writing process in general. Can you tell when you are in the moment of self-service versus other service and sort of talk about that in general?
That's a distinction I have a little trouble with. I think that when you sit down and write, you're capable of doing good stuff, bad stuff, all the things that we know. Hello?
Yeah, you're here. You're here.
That we know we're capable of. And I think the trick when, for me, as both an editor, is to be able to write something, let it come out, however it does, and then let it sit overnight and see what you think of it in the morning. And very often when I've written something and I want to really take a look at it, I leave my study, I go into another room, or I go to a cafe, or I sit in the park when the weather is good, because I want to be in another place, not in the place of the writing, but in the place of the reading.
Mm-hmm. Does it help you to have been an editor when editing your own work, or do you think that gets in your way?
It doesn't get in my way, because over time I learned how to be how to have two brains. At first I was nervous about writing because nothing was good enough, because I was using my editorial hat. And then I realized that my editorial brain would click in eventually, but I really needed to put it away while I was writing. And the first criterion I discovered was, you know, I'd write 10 pages in a day, and I'd wake up in the morning, and sometimes it was just boring.
Hmm.
If it wasn't interesting to me, I threw it away.
Yeah. I'm glad you said that, because I think that the editor comes in too early on in the writing process too often and sort of stifles whatever the writer is trying to do, you know, and that you can't get sort of the raw things out first before the critic comes in.
As an editor, I always, you know, I worked with some very great writers and thinkers in the course of my 40 years, and I got them to trust me to show me their early drafts, which was an act of great faith. And I would say to them, I'm not your school teacher. I'm your co-conspirator in making a good book.
Mm.
and that made a big difference, because then we could get into the heart of what they were thinking and writing together.
Right, right. Something that struck me as I was reading this was kind of this notion of secrecy versus privacy. And, you know, what secrecy versus the sacred, and what people really have a right to have access to, and what's a secret and what's your private life? And I was wondering if you kind of bumped against that distinction and if you drew any conclusions about it.
Well, I think that what I'm talking about in my book are the secrets that are within our heart, the ones that weigh heavily.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think that, and they pertain to family. I think that my purview for this book is what happens when the front door is shut. I think that people have a right to their privacy, and I think they have a right not to share details with anybody except the people whose lives would be impacted by their secrets.
Right, right.
And it's a very simple thing. And another thing I've come to realize is there's one kind of secret you really, really shouldn't tell, and that's somebody else's secret.
Right, right.
Unless there's abuse. But, I mean, the idea that we should put everything out there is quite different from what I'm talking about.
Right. Yeah, so it's withholding things that would have an impact on somebody else versus your
right.
own kind of private thoughts, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You brought up this point about a counterexample to sharing secrets, one being other people's secrets. Did you find that there were points where it could be harmful or ill-advised to share secrets?
Yeah, there's another category. As you know, in my book, I say that once the secret is out, the secret keeper, who has now come to the truth, told the truth, has an obligation to the secret finder, if they want to continue a relationship, to explain what happened and what they were thinking. And those long conversations, if they take place, can lead to some kind of resolution, whether it's never to see each other again or to stay in some kind of relationship. But when somebody makes a deathbed confession and tells a secret and then goes dies, there's no possibility for conversation. There's no possibility for resolution. And I think that is a case where if you've got a secret and you know you have to get it off your chest, do it, and because it's really on your mind and your heart, do it. Don't wait until you're dying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good advice. My guest this morning is Jane Isay. The book is Secrets and Lies, Surviving the Truths That Change Our Lives. And you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Was it difficult for you when you went through the research process of talking to all of these people, of choosing which stories to include and which stories to perhaps leave out?
Oh, sure. That's one of the great tasks that you have to do when you write anything, which is, what do you keep in and what do you get rid of? I was attached to certain stories because I really, really, really love the people. I tend to like the people I've interviewed anyway, but some of them just weren't relevant to the book. There's a whole chapter I left out, which was about the silence of the men and women who came back from World War II and never, ever spoke about their experiences. And that was a chapter that was going to be called, that was called Lies My Father Told Me. But it didn't fit in the book, so I cut it out. And there were some stories that where the point was, you could tell, there's a story of some secret and telling where it could have 15 different ways of being interpreted, and those were a little vague for the book.
I was going to ask you about that, about whether there were stories that you sort of felt like you had to massage to make them fit in with the theme of the book, or I guess those are just stories you would leave out, right?
Well, sure, but every story, now that's a really important question. When you're hearing about such a key aspect of somebody's life, there are 360 degrees of the circle that you could consider when writing it. So then you have to sit and struggle. What's the deep meaning of this? What's it really about? And then you leave out other focuses because you're going for what you think is the heart of the story. That's true for every writer writing anything. At least I can say that having edited people and told them, it's time for you to figure out what this is about.
That's a great point. That's a great point. And, you know, another thing that struck me is writing in a non-judgmental way while advancing a particular point of view. You know, your point of view is it's better to share your secrets with the people you care about so that they can make an informed decision about whether or not to carry on the relationship. And yet you approach it in this very empathetic, non-judgmental, open-minded way. And I think that's
Thank
a really
you.
Elegant line to navigate.
Well, no, you know, it really, that is, part of that comes from draft after draft after draft. You know, when I start a book, I buy a carton of 10 reams of paper.
Mm-hmm.
And that will get me through about a third of the book. I just write and print. And over the course of time, I see where I am being, where I am biased one way or another, and I know that's the wrong thing to do. This is my third book, and I've learned that. Mary Pfeiffer, who's reviving Ophelia, I was lucky enough to discover and edit. She read the first draft of my first book, and she said, "You don't have enough empathy, Jane." And I said, "Oh, my God," I went back, and I worked like a dog. And that's where she's really responsible for my understanding that you have to really care about everybody in the story, even the perpetrator.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. My guest this morning, again, is Jane Isay. The book is Secrets and Lies. And let's talk about what those first initial drafts look like in comparison to the final draft. And kind of the gap or chasm of what the difference looked like. How did it start versus how did it end? And did your mind change over the course of writing it about any of the essential truths you were writing about?
Sure. I didn't really know what I thought when I started a book. I used to, you know, as an editor, I used to buy proposals, you know, buy books on the basis of a proposal.
Mm-hmm.
And writers would say, "Well, what if the book doesn't turn out exactly as I've outlined?" And my response was, "If your book turned out exactly as you outlined, I wouldn't want to publish it."
Right, right.
Because you got to learn things.
Right.
I learned a great deal. You know, this is more about content than form. What when I start writing, it's all terrible. And I have to write my way through my opinions, my biases, my pain, until I find a paragraph or two that really work.
Yeah.
And I learned so much from the writing of this book. I really didn't have a point of view about this. I knew that when you share a hard truth, you stand on firm ground. But that I really learned from the story that ends my book, which is the death of my beloved second husband. Because when we shared the fact, he knew that he was dying and he didn't try to avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
And that intimacy of sharing a really, really the worst truth taught me something about the power of the truth. And I came to believe this mantra, which is, "At least I know." You can take anything if you really know it.
Yeah, yeah. That's a great insight. You know, looking over the course of all three of your books, one dealing with your sons, one dealing with your siblings, and this one dealing with your first husband, when you're, implication is the wrong word, but when you are involving those around you that you love in your work, how does that, do you worry about that relationship with these people, or do you just go for writing the truth and...
Anything that is in any of my books is about any of my family. They get complete. I send them a draft saying, "This doesn't even have to be in the book. Let me know what you think."
Mm. That's nice of you. I think most people wouldn't do that. Actually, that's pretty nice.
Well,
of you.
Well, you know, I had a friend who was being pushed to write a book about a very, very painful family circumstance, and if she wrote it, she'd lose her son. She asked me, "What should I do?" And I said, "Do no harm."
Right.
Who cares about a book?
Right.
If you want to keep your son, don't write the book.
Right.
And she was so relieved. She came to me later and said, "I called my husband. I'm not writing the book. I'm so relieved."
Oh.
I mean, there is, and that is something I believe as an editor and a writer. There is a writer's Hippocratic oath that you shall do no harm to the people you write about.
Hmm. I like that. You know, I think that's more rare than common, actually, that attitude. And I think it's a wise one. I think it's a wise
Thank
one.
Thank you.
Relationships come first. We're drawing down on our time, but I'm wondering if you have writing advice, wisdom for people either writing in the nonfiction realm, in the memoir realm, what you've drawn from these experiences.
That's a good question. I think if you have something you want to say, figure out how to say it in the most honest way. I don't worry so much about the language. I worry about the feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can find that part of your being where your deepest feelings and emotions are, then you will make connection with your readers. And every piece of your book and your writing that makes a connection with a reader, a different kind of reader, a different sort of reader, will help you find an audience. So that's advice I gave my authors always, and that's advice that I have taken. But it really, really, really is about feeling and emotion, not so much about the words.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like things that you were working on in this book beget another book? Yeah, does one project feed another?
Actually, I decided to wait to think of another book project when I did this, mainly because the book business has changed, so I wanted to see what would happen.
Yeah.
I have another idea for a book, but I'm not telling you. It's a secret.
That's a secret you should keep. I won't tell it. Any insights into the publishing industry and where it's going, being from the editorial side?
Well, it's chaotic, and it's disappointing. The outlets that used to be there for publicity and promotion have changed. But, you know, there are very smart and dedicated people in all aspects of the publishing industry, and there are lots of readers looking for good writing and good thinking. So it's changing, and it's terrible, but it's not going away.
Yeah. Tell us, you keep a blog on this, so tell us where we can find you online.
It's janeisay.com. That's janeisay.com. That's my website. And I'm also blogging for Psychology Today and Huffington, but all the links are on the website.
Oh, that's great. And people seem to keep sharing their secrets with you.
They do. I'm getting letters. Yeah. With people are writing me, telling me their secrets. And, you know, it's really the thing about this book is that there's a lot of pain in the book.
Yes.
But I hope that by reading of others' struggles, people who read the book will get some comfort and some peace for themselves.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think that's right. Jane Isay, thanks so much for taking the time this morning.
Oh, it was great. Thank
Huge
you.
Huge pleasure. Thanks again. That was Jane Isay, the book Secrets and Lies, Surviving the Truths That Change Our Lives is available now, published by Doubleday. You can find her online, as she said, at janeisay.com. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Laurie Haltz Anderson will be here for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
KUCI. It makes me wanna. KUCI. It makes me wanna. KUCI. It makes me wanna. KUCI. 88.9 FM in Irvine.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. I know there's a speaker series event coming up in February, so you'll make sure to check out her website for that. Those events sell out pretty quickly. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. I'm joined now by Laurie Haltz Anderson. Laurie Haltz Anderson is the New York Times bestselling author who writes for kids of all ages. Known for tackling tough subjects with humor and sensitivity, her work has earned numerous national and state awards, as well as international recognition. Two of her books, Speak and Chains, were National Book Award finalists. Laurie was honored with the 2009 Margaret A. Edwards Award given by YALSA, Division of American Library Association, for her significant and lasting contribution to young adult literature. Her latest novel is The Impossible Knife of Memory. She is the mother of four, wife of one, joining me from New York, where she likes to watch the snow fall as she writes. I'm guessing she gets to do a lot of that today. Laurie, welcome.
Thank you so much.
That's become your specialty over there, I'm sure. I feel a bit guilty, you know, calling you from the 75-degree weather of Southern California, but stay warm. So I am going to let you talk first about this book, The Impossible Knife of Memory. Kind of take us into it. Talk about the inspiration for what motivated you to write it and a little bit about the scope of it.
Okay. The inspiration was when my nephew came home from war a few years ago. We're very close with him, and we've watched as he's tried to, and his friends have tried to reintegrate into civilian society, sometimes with success, sometimes with not so much success. And watching his struggles and the struggles of his friends made me think back on the experience my family had when I was a young teenager, because that's when my father had his own issues. My dad was a World War II vet who, when he was 18 years old, was sent to Dachau just after the camp had been liberated. And he and his compatriots had to bury the dead, try to care for the living, and make sense of one of the most senseless brutalities that the world has ever seen. My dad became a minister out of his desire to make the world a better place after he had seen Nazi Germany. And by the time we got to the Vietnam War era, when I was a young teenager, all those memories, all that pain and trauma that he had tried to keep buckled up and buried just escaped and took over our lives. My dad lost his job. He became a very unpredictable, sometimes very angry alcoholic. And what I remember most was just how confusing it was. You know, we had been such a wonderful family, and then all of a sudden it seemed overnight my father turned into another person, and my mother refused to talk about it. So when I watched my nephew, jumping back to the present day, come home and became more sensitive to the PTSD issues that so many American families are dealing with, I realized that I had a perspective that might lend itself to trying to tell this story. So our main character in this book, though, is not me. She's much braver than I was. Much stronger, too. I think she's who I wish I had been. Mm. Haley Rose is trying to take care of her dad, trying to become a parent to a parent who can't really function anymore. After a lot of wandering, she and her dad have settled down in his old hometown. And, she's having to go through the motions of high school, which she thinks are absurd. And she's always afraid when she steps in the front door because she doesn't know who she's going to find on the other side of that door.
Yeah. I was wondering as I was reading this, because I was a product of a dad who was in Vietnam, and a lot of the same issues, you know, were circulating around my childhood as yours and as Haley's. And I was wondering if you noticed across war to war if you think there are different issues that are presented for the vets and their families, or if war is just sort of a consistent thing that affects people and the human condition sort of in the same way.
I think that that the trauma of war is relentless and doesn't change from generation to generation. What we're seeing now, though, is because our ability to treat people in the field has improved so dramatically, we now have a lot of soldiers returning from war who would not have survived their battlefield scars in previous wars. So they're coming home with very complex medical needs, some of them, on top of the emotional needs of people who have these kinds of untreated traumas. Somebody asked me recently if I felt that that my book might help the conversation, and really I hope this book is read by politicians. Because the lack of resources available to our veterans and to their families is an abomination. We should all be horrified and embarrassed. These families need our love and our support more than anybody that I can think of.
I want to talk a little bit about your connection to the childhood age group. You write for kind of for kids of all ages. My daughter has read you in the lower grades, and I know you write for the upper grades. And sort of the unique perspective of connecting with children as opposed to connecting with adults. I assume that's been an enduring thing for you all the way through your writing career. But talk a little bit about how you can get to people of that age group so effectively, and what appeals to you about writing for children and the young adult audience.
Well, I actually think kids and teenagers are a little bit more interesting than adults, in all honesty. You know, they haven't had their curiosity and their passion for life eaten out of them yet, so they're really fun to hang out with. Books were just so important to me growing up. I spent half of my time, you know, in the world of fiction, and it's a real delight to be able to try to contribute to the body of fiction that our young people read. I think the fact that, I went through a really difficult phase from about seventh grade through college because of the issues that my family was facing because of my own trauma after an assault. I probably am more sensitive to the emotional needs of younger readers than I would have otherwise been. The other exciting thing about writing for kids and teenagers, though, is that think about your memories from when you were 14 or 17 or even 8. When you're experiencing life for the first time, you're experiencing it in a really enhanced, kind of loud and vivid, stimulating way. So the books that you interact with, just they worm their way into your heart. And it's very rare as an adult to have an experience with literature or art that's as intense as those childhood experiences. So it is just a wonderful audience to write for.
Yeah, isn't that true? Right. Are there rules of young adult fiction? Because I know in a lot of writing workshops, people talk about, is this geared towards the YA audience? And I always wonder if it's a matter of, just having a young adult protagonist, or if there are content concerns that you worry about, language concerns that you worry about, sort of the rules that kind of govern that genre, or it seems like young adult fiction has gotten much more sophisticated, so maybe those rules don't apply as much as they used to?
That's a great, interesting conversation topic right there. I think that there are definitely rules in terms of language and content for literature that's aimed at middle grade readers, like my historical books. But I don't really believe that those rules exist much more when it comes to books for teens. For one thing, the line between YA fiction and adult fiction is very blurred. When Speak came out 15 years ago, there was teen books and there were adult books. Now I'm having people coming up to me at book signings who read Speak at 15 and who are now 30, and really they prefer to read young adult books. If you talk to kind of the scholars of young adult literature, it's fascinating to listen to them talk about what is YA. I think it's changing as our teens change. I don't worry about content. For me, foul language that makes some people really nervous, I don't use much of it in my books, but only because it's boring.
Right.
If you have teens in a book talk the way many teens talk in real life, then every other word, you're dropping a swear word, and it gets really dull on the page. So it's lazy writing, frankly.
Lazy, yeah,
so
that's a great word, yeah.
Yeah, so I do use, you know, and I think in places where they're called for, there's a reason that we have curse words in our language, because sometimes you need a word that has a lot of strength to convey the strength of emotion. And if you hold off as a writer until those moments to use those words, then they carry a lot more punch.
Right, right. This book sounds like it was on the more personal end of the spectrum for you, perhaps, than maybe some of the historical fiction that you've written or whatnot. Talk about mining from the personal versus mining from the imagination and how that differs in your books.
You know, every story has its own roots in a writer's heart. You know, and obviously we're all capable of writing from our own experience. You know, cause some people like to say write what you know, which only takes you so far. I think you also have to write what you want to know. But, you know, the range of human experience is fairly broad, and it doesn't matter what the topic is. There will be some aspect of that topic that concerns love, that concerns fear. And so when you're pulling from the emotional end, you tend to pull from your own emotional circumstances, which is why I think as writers get older, I think their writing often becomes richer because they have more experience to pull from,
yeah.
Which is kind of exciting. It's one of those few careers in the arts that you can improve as you age because you have more to bring to the table. So it's important when you're developing a story that if it's outside your experience, to find places where you connect either with significant moments in the plot or, you know, different aspects of the important characters. Because you have to find a way to put your own truth on the page, even if it's completely disguised.
Yeah, yeah. My guest this morning is Laurie Holtz-Anderson. The book is The Impossible Knife of Memory. I'm doing okay with your name. I know it's a pet peeve.
Oh, you're doing great.
Okay.
Congratulations.
I knew this was a point of bad things, so I wanted to make sure I was right. You wrote about getting stuck, and I thought your words of wisdom on this, getting stuck as a writer, getting stuck in I don't know if you'd call it writer's block or if you'd just call it, you know, kind of getting lost from the forest, from the trees in a piece of work. And you said that usually means that you don't understand your character and the conflict she's facing. And so to sit down and kind of brainstorm 10 things that could happen next. I love that as a device for a lot of the writers that I talk to that have gotten stuck in their work. I was wondering if that sort of happened to you in this book and if there were points where it was unclear to you where this was going to go and kind of how you got Haley out of it.
Oh, thanks. I love talking about writing, so thanks so much for that question. Yeah, and to go back to, you know, brainstorming in the middle of a project, I think it's really important to remember that no book is ever written the way your English teacher tells you it's going to be written. because, you know, which is not to downgrade the contributions of English teachers, but novels are not quite, you know, the essays that one has to learn how to do in school. And as you dive into a novel, characters unfold in very unpredictable ways. Plots do too. And that means you can be deep into your revision sometimes and you have an epiphany about a character or a turn that the story takes, and you have to go back to square one in terms of your process and do some brainstorming. You might have to research. You might have to rethink everything, which, frankly, I think is kind of exciting. It would be really dull if it was just brainstorm, outline, draft one, draft two. Who wants to do that?
Right.
It's art. You know, you have to get in there with both hands and muck around in it until you come up with something. One of the bigger craft challenges for me in this book was that I had two fairly significant plot lines. The most important story is Haley's journey with her dad as they try to work out their relationship and stumble, hopefully, in the direction of a stronger family and better health for them both. But I also wanted to write a love interest in the story, which I've never done before. So that was kind of interesting, but the tricky part was maintaining the tension and the pacing between the unfolding of the two plot lines. So there were a lot of chapters that wound up on the cutting room floor in this book. And just that was, exasperating sometimes, as it always is. But as the final story started take shape, it was very exciting to see, you know, how when you hear a good, a great piece of music that's got point and counterpoint and how it builds off each other. And that's what I was really working for in this book. You know, it was tough to figure out how to, you have so many different triangular relationships in this book, which is where you always find tension. You know, it's a lot easier to write tension in a scene if you have three characters in the scene as opposed to two. So I do a lot of triangles all over my manuscript, trying to see who's playing off of whom and how do we get them to the next point in the story.
Yeah, perfectly observed. And I'm wondering if in all of the things that get cut out of the book, if in fact those sort of psychologically get somehow put back in, because I can't imagine that too much work is actually lost. I mean, it's all insight into character and insight into motivation. And I'm wondering if it sort of gets in the back door of, you know, how the character acts. It's all good work, right?
Oh, absolutely. I never feel bad about cutting things out, because I had to write that scene or that paragraph or description or whatever in order to get to the next place.
Right, right.
You know, when you go hiking, you don't regret the steps you took to get to the mountaintop.
Right.
There's no other way up.
Right, right. So it sounds like it's more of a process of letting the character guide the way and then in the aftermath going back and seeing where she's taken you and kind of how to keep her on the path. I wonder if it's almost like outlining after the fact.
It's interesting. My process is very different between my contemporary YA novels and my historicals. My historicals are deeply rooted in historical facts, so they almost outline themselves, because I have to figure out how my characters are going to interact with the reality of, you know, the American Revolution and certain time and place. And then the challenge is to figure out what the interior arcs and growth patterns of those characters are. My YAs are exactly the opposite. They start with a strong character. I don't start writing until I can hear my main character whispering. You know, and what I've done probably for months and sometimes years ahead of time is to ponder whatever situation I know this character is facing. In this case, a dad who's got PTSD that's untreated. And then once I begin to visualize a character and you start to see scenes, you know, it's almost like a ghost shows up. And you never look a ghost head on, because then they vanish. If you're going to look at it out the corner of your eye. I never know how my YAs are going to end until I get to the end of the first draft. And my first drafts are just such messes. But by the end of the first draft, I finally understand who the character is. I understand what is likely the touch points of the novel, the really significant big scenes. And then I go back in, and actually revision is my favorite thing to do, because it's, you know, you take this mess of a first draft and you try to put some logic into it, some structure. And that's where all those handy little craft tools come into play.
I wonder if there is, I don't know, advice might be the wrong word, but something you can tell people to trust the process, because I think people get halfway through this first draft. It looks like a mess. They're freaked out. You know, they don't know what to make of it. They don't know how to massage it. And to trust in the whole process of, you have to get that first draft down to know where to go. You know, the process is so long. It's so lonely. And I don't know if having a body of work behind you and having been through the process before helps you at the next blank page of the computer screen for the next book. It has to help a little. But just knowing that process is going to work itself out, right, I suppose, in the dismal numbers of the publishing world.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It doesn't help. Having had some books published doesn't help as much as I would hope. Mm-hmm. I actually, when I was deep into this book and really in the ucky part of the writing process, I seriously thought about becoming an X-ray technician. I'm completely serious. I looked up like where I would go to school and how long it would take and how much it would cost, because I thought, gosh, it'd be so nice to have a job where I just show up to work and do my hours and then I get a paycheck. You know, how easy is that? That would be lovely.
That's funny.
But it's really important to remember that even after you've written a book and it's been published and people say they like it, when you go down to write your next book, you've never written that next book before. You're starting all over from scratch, which is the good news and the bad news. This is where it's super important, I think, for all writers to have buddies, to have friends who are also writers, You know, my best friend is a writer in New York City, and boy, do we talk each other out of dark places sometimes, because it is, like you said, it's lonely, you feel lost. We are raised in an educational system that doesn't give us much experience in staying in a messy place for very long, right? We're given projects that are short-term duration and that have expectations, and you're supposed to get perfect quickly in American schools. But if you're an artist, if you're a writer, you have to spend a lot of time in uncertainty because inspiration unfolds slowly. The mistake I see a lot of people make is that they have their idea comes from an inspired place, and maybe their character comes from an inspired place, but then they turn on their editing brain much too early in the process. Mm. And so the books are driven intellectually instead of from their spirit, from the magic heart of writing. And it's because of their discomfort in that time in the writing process where you really have no clue what's going on and you're convinced that you're wasting your time. Sometimes you really need to find a way to make peace with that discomfort and keep mucking about.
Right, right. My guest this morning is Laurie Holt Sanderson. The book is The Impossible Knife of Memory. I'm wondering, as the audience, your audience changes, their sophistication level changes, their technology in imbued lifestyle changes, do you find it harder to connect with them, or do you think the same sort of essential human truths remain constant that you can connect with on the page?
Oh, my goodness, I think it's actually easier to connect because, you know, story with a capital S will never change. That is in our DNA, to tell stories and to want to receive stories because they connect us in such a deep, important way. Now with all these different technologies, that just increases the ability of readers and writers to connect with each other. Some people, you know, people for whom reading text is a challenging thing, audiobooks are there for them. One of the things that I think you're going to start seeing writers like me take advantage of in the next decade is the amazing opportunities that hypertext can offer an author. No one's really done it deeply yet, but, you know, and my books have been turned into e-books. But imagine the enhanced e-book of a text where if you wanted to click a link, you could go into a kind of a hidden chapter that maybe, you know, something's from my cutting room floor, you know, or there's just so many more things we can do with a non-paper-based book. I don't think that electronic media is ever going to fully replace paper-based books.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, what do I know? I'm certainly not I don't have a magic ball, sadly. Yeah. But I know that story will never change.
Yeah.
And so that's good.
Yeah, that is good. That is good. And I like your marathon run, or your, I don't know, your marathon runner, but your running seems to, you're a runner. And
yeah.
I do think that that discipline, the staying in the hard place, the whatever mind clearing endorphins that are released in running. I know a lot of writers who were runners. And it does seem to feed it.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I just last year got a treadmill for my office that I turn into a desk. And I often write walking very slowly because I've found for me that sitting still all day guarantees that I'll write really bad stuff. Mm-hmm. And that movement, I probably because I get oxygenated blood to my brain, is important. So, you know, there's a reason Charles Dickens walked as much as he did, and we all benefit from it. Also, you know, I have run a marathon, and I'd like to train for another one soon. And I had to make peace a long time ago with the fact that I am not a fast runner. I will never be a fast runner. I run at the pace that I run, and I really enjoy it. And I think that translates seamlessly to writing process. It's a little tempting sometimes for people to try to compare their process with other people's process or compare their works with somebody else's book, and there's nothing to be gained by that. Your journey is to write the stories that only you can write in the manner and at the pace that you can write them and to try to have fun with it.
Hmm. That is a lovely sentiment to end on. Laurie Holt Sanderson, thanks so much for taking the time this morning. This was wonderful.
This was really fun. Thanks so much for the chance to talk to you.
My pleasure. That was Laurie Halse Anderson. The book is The Impossible Knife of Memory. It is out and available now. You can find her online. You can certainly find the book online. That's all the time we have for today. Barbara DeMarco Barrett will be back here with you next Wednesday morning, 9 a.m. on KUCI 88.9 FM. Stay tuned for Roots and Rhythms coming up next on KUCI. And thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.